Hello, and welcome to the second episode of Season 3 of Typecast, Boston's new play podcast. I'm Darren Evans, the Managing Director of Boston Playwrights Theatre, the home for new plays in Boston. In this podcast series, we are diving deep into the new play ecosystem of Beantown, talking with playwrights, directors, actors, and theatre makers of all varieties about the process of bringing new plays into the world. For this episode, I am very excited to have two good friends of BPT with us, playwright and faculty member of our MFA playwriting program, Ronan Noon, along with Lyric Stage Company producing artistic director, Courtney O'Connor. They are right now in the thick of mounting the Boston premiere of Ronan's play, Thirst. Let's do some quick intros. Originally hailing from Ireland, Ronan Noon is a graduate of the National University of Ireland in Galway, earning degrees in, not playwriting, mathematics and politics, and later a postgraduate in journalism. He started his career as a journalist, working for newspapers in Ireland and Prague before immigrating to the United States, where he is a graduate of our playwriting program and where he now teaches. He's won a slew of prestigious awards, including Best Playwright Award at the First Irish Festival of New York, the inaugural winner of the Association for Theatre and Higher Education Excellence in Playwriting Award, and an Edgerton Award, and Boston's own Elliot Norton Award for Best New Script. Among his many notable works are The Smuggler, The Atheist, Brendan, Scenes from an Adultery, The Balya Trilogy, and Little Black Dress. Ronan, it is a pleasure to have you with us.
Delighted. Thank you for doing this.
Also joining us today is director Courtney O'Connor. Courtney is the producing artistic director at the Lyric Stage Company of Boston. She has directed many plays for the Lyric, including The Book of Will, Be Here Now, The Cake, Red Hot Patriot, and another Irish classic, Stones in Its Pockets. For the past 20 years, Courtney has been an affiliated faculty member with Emerson College, where she has taught directing and acting, directed productions for Emerson Stage, and headed the pre-college summer intensive acting and musical theater programs. In addition to directing for theaters and universities, Courtney has directed multiple site-specific productions at locations including Mount Auburn Cemetery, I saw those plays, so good, really loved that, and Boston's Old State House. Courtney has received the Elliot Norton Award for her work as the associate director on the Lyric Stage production of The Life and Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby and the Alan L. Stanzler Award for Excellence in Teaching. Courtney, it is a pleasure to have you with us today.
It's lovely to be here, Darren. Thank you so much.
All right, let's dive into Thirst, but this play is a little bit different in that it is very much referencing, or it's related to, another play, perhaps one of the most famous plays in the American theater, Eugene O'Neill's magnum opus, Long Day's Journey into Night. So before we get into talking about Thirst, a quick, very quick, two-sentence overview of Long Day's Journey into Night will give us some context. In a nutshell, the story of Long Day's Journey into Night is a semi-autobiographical one, with the Tyrone family standing in for O'Neill's own family, and basically deals with the family members struggling with their demons, including addiction, health problems, money problems, and moral failings. Set in 1912, it takes place over the course of one long day, as you could probably guess from the title, with a great deal of drinking, arguing, and self-delusion, coupled with brutal honesty. All right, so let's talk about what we're here to talk about, though, which is Thirst. So, Ronan, many of O'Neill's contemporaries like Ibsen or Chekhov, they have got minor characters in their works that serve as household staff. You could have chosen any of those. Why did you choose Long Day's Journey as the starting point for this upstairs, downstairs, back room tale?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I obviously, I have an affiliation with O'Neill because of the Irish connection. His works are filled with immigrant characters, not just Irish immigrant characters. But I was reading O'Neill when I was an undergraduate and didn't fully understand a lot of the plays. But as I got older, I started understanding that I had a direct connection to the outsider feel that he gave to some of the characters in his plays. And once I started looking at Long Day's Journey Into Night, I realized that the minor character of Kathleen, who is the second girl in that play, I had a connection to the idea of her life in the kitchen while the play was going on, Long Day's Journey Into Night, simultaneously in the living room. And I wondered what was going on in that kitchen. And I thought to myself, well, whatever experience I have as an immigrant coming to America, maybe it's going to inform the emotional impact of what their life was like in the kitchen. So there's a certain level of both arrogance in the sense of, yes, I can connect to these, to this young woman working in the kitchen, but also to the sense that, yes, I understand what it means to be uprooted, deracinated, and to move from one country to another and try and make a life for yourself. So I put all those pieces together and Thirst came from that.
So, Courtney, you programmed this play into your season. So you chose to put it on, and you're directing it yourself. How did you first encounter the script? What made you want to tackle it?
I read about this in the New England New Play newsletter that comes out every once in a while. And I saw that last summer it was being produced up at Dorset Theater Festival. So I made the journey up there to go see it. I guess now it was two summers ago, right? It feels like it was just last summer, but it was two summers ago. So I made the journey up there to see it. And as soon as the play began, I felt like I knew these characters, especially the women. I think being an Irish American, having ancestors who all came over and were servants from Ireland in households, it just resonated within my soul. And I knew by intermission that I needed us to be able to bring this piece to Boston. So was fortunate enough that I reached out to Dorset. They connected me with Ronan. We had just a delightful conversation the first time we spoke. It felt like sitting down and talking with a long lost relative, with a cousin that I just hadn't seen in a number of years. And the conversation just kept going. And so it just felt like such a natural fit on so many different levels. And I was so thrilled that Ronan was game for us to bring it to the Lyric stage.
Ronan, you mentioned Kathleen, the second girl that appears on Long Day's Journey. She's one of the three central characters in Thirst. Based on the draft of the script that I read, and from what I know about the production, the Tyrones themselves, the main family in Long Day's Journey, don't make an appearance on stage. I'm wondering, did any of your earlier drafts include a Tyrone popping in, or did you always want to omit them entirely and focus on the kitchen staff?
I never admitted them into the play as a character, as a physical presence. But the early drafts had lines always popping through from sitting in the dining room waiting for food, lines that are in Long Day's Journey Into Night shouting that may occur. And after a while, that became overwhelming. So through many drafts, I kind of culled all of those lines to maybe one or two that felt enough to kind of allow that sense of the outside room being there. But it's culled to minimal amount now at the most. And so that's all that is needed as far as I could see. It was important for me that the story of Thirst became its own play. And yes, it'd be lovely to have it in conversation with Long Day's Journey Into Night, but it became more and more important for me to actually tell their story and allow those three characters to live their own life and not dependent. In fact, even more so, not dependent on what was going on from their employers.
Courtney, you've directed classic plays and contemporary plays, and Ronan and I were chit-chatting before we started recording, and he mentioned that he was at the first rehearsal for this and swung by last week during the rehearsal. What is different in your process when you've got the playwright available in the rehearsal room and, you know, consulting on your production? Do you do anything differently, or is it totally the same?
I think much of it for me is the same, because you're still entering into the world, but you have this additional resource that you can go to for moments that are eluding you or questions that are coming up. And there's one line that I sent to Ronan last week and was like, we don't understand what this line is. Can you help us with it? And he just gave a quick one-line answer, and it completely transformed that chunk of the scene for us. And so having the ability to have that voice to go to have that thought, to understand what was in the playwright's mind, is such a gift. And of course we can muddle through it if the playwright, like O'Neill, is no longer in this world and we can't ask them. But the joy of having that person available, of having another collaborator to say, is this lining up with how you saw it? Is this what you were envisioning? It's just spectacular when you're able to do that, when you're able to have that extra voice in the room. It's such a joy.
You know what? I'm just stepping in here on that too. What's wonderful, just staying in the room, is time makes a huge difference, as we all know. But in the early years, the anxiety would just drive me demented. You feel like you have to step in on everything, explain everything. You maybe even have immediate notes for the director or immediate notes for the actor. You don't know what you're doing. But time, and having been in enough rooms at this stage and seen directors work and actors trying to figure out something that's automatic to you, now has become just astonishing. I just watching the levels of intelligence as they're piecing pieces together and bringing the play to life is just like astonishing, just spectacular. It's just part of the process now that's just wonderful. Watching Courtney ask questions of Amy, who plays the character of Bridget, and watching Amy answer those questions while figuring out how they relate to her character in the play that I have taken for granted, and then start realizing as we go along that maybe I didn't fully understand it, and they're pulling these edges off it that that were in both the subtext and in the word itself. And that to me, I have to say, I love it. And I love the fact of being in the theater and not carrying that sense of desperation. And that doesn't mean desperation for success. It means just the desperation for every line that doesn't feel like a clenched fist. And every playwright knows what I'm talking about. They know this. And I can imagine, Courtney, you've dealt with playwrights, and certainly maybe in my younger years, but where you've had playwrights in the room and you're like, oh my God, you're bringing so much freaking tension. You got to leave.
It's not for me. It's not so much you have to leave. Like, I want the playwright there, but I'm so terrified the whole time that the playwright is there, because you want to do justice to their work. We want to make you proud. We want to bring this to life in the way that, in a way that makes you, like you said, that makes you find things in it that you didn't know, but also see what you knew it was enhanced and vibrating and just resonating in the room. And so it's always both this mixture of excitement when the playwright is there and the terror, because you just don't want to let them down.
I love that.
And it's funny when you talk about the time, because when I was younger, I would, if a playwright was in the room, I would automatically defer to them. I was scared to speak if they were in the room. But now I think that similar time journey that you've had, now I feel like I'm going to speak and we can talk after, or we can sidebar if it's not what you're thinking. But it's much more comfortable for me now to have playwrights in the room.
So funny, because I have a question here. I was going to ask you about the sort of tension, nervousness of the playwright in the room, and I don't need to ask it. You both anticipated it perfectly. Well done. So I'm going to move on to my next question, Ronan. So I read a draft of Thirst, I think maybe not the draft that you're working on. And I was struck, I have to say, particularly in relation to Long Day's Journey, which is a pretty bleak play, but I was kind of struck by the hopeful ending of Thirst when I read it. So I'm wondering, I don't want to give anything away, so I'm going to ask a general question. When you're writing, do you think at all about a tone or a feeling that you want to impart to the audience? Like, ideally, this is how I want the audience to feel when they walk out the door, or is that not at all a consideration?
It wasn't a consideration, and I should have thought deeper about it. I thought, I just want to tell the story and let's see what happens. And then as I was telling it, I saw I was being influenced very much so by O'Neill and the shadow of O'Neill and the kind of hanging over me and hovering. And as you let that hover, you start realizing that you're falling into a lot of his tropes, a lot of his style. And then it becomes anachronistic in terms of dialogue. And next thing, the tone is infiltrated by maybe sometimes a maudlin line that just does not work, or maudlin nature across the whole piece. Sometimes melodrama fits in there, and you're realizing, and this happens through all the drafts, that what you're doing is sometimes imitating, and that just does not work. And so it took me a long time to understand that even though we're saying that Thirst is in conversation with Long Day's Journey into Night, what was more important to me to do this play was to say that the immigrant process is not full of just terror and dysfunction, that even I have come through this process to say there's a joy in the struggle. There is a certain sense of beginning life again, putting down your roots and finding a new way through that America offers to you. And certainly we can find the bad things on that too, but I'm not concentrating on that necessarily because I've come through the process. A lot of my friends have come through the process, and they see a success in their life and ambition that's been fulfilled. Some, not all, but dreams are there. And I thought that's the conversation that this play is trying to have. And then it became more apparent to me that really, in what was going on in the other room, was a level of dysfunction that often portrayed the immigrant process as hardship, difficult and struggle, and certainly it's there and leading towards, you know, alcoholism and taking drugs. That was not what I was interested in. I was interested in the joy and the struggle, and so I wanted to contrast out with the hardship, with also how they can find wonderful moments throughout the day that allow them to be astonished by what they are going through and not let it pull them down. And so then the tone became really about finding that joy in the struggle. And then it opened itself up to me, and that became much more important in terms of the contrast between the two plays.
Amazing. All right, we're going to take a short break for a message from this episode's sponsor. We will be returning shortly with further questions for Ronan and Courtney and a fun game to wrap us up. We'll be right back. Are you single but not really ready to mingle? When you say Netflix and chill, do you actually mean binging Brooklyn Nine-Nine and eating a bowl of Rocky Road? Then meet your new favorite dating app, Fringe, dating for introverts. Fringe is perfect for folks who love to make plans with people, but love it even more when those people cancel so you can just stay home. Our custom design algorithm will match you with potential mates who are also keen not to actually go anywhere, making the odds of having to get out there and make small talk with a stranger less than 10%. And with unlimited messaging and storage, you can make, cancel, reschedule, and recancel your dates as many times as you want, forever. Fringe has all the heady anticipation of swiping right and potentially meeting that special someone, without the hassle of getting ready or the inevitable disappointment of leaving the house and spending time with other humans. Sign up for Fringe today with our special 20% off discount code, HELLNO. Fringe, when your special someone is really your couch.
Ronan, I want to pick up on something that you were talking about right before we went to commercial break. You've written a bunch of plays set in Ireland. Thirst is not that, but very much about the immigrant experience, as you were discussing. What is it about Ireland and Irish characters that continues to spark your creativity?
I don't know if they do actually anymore.
Oh, all right. Yeah. I made an assumption.
No, I remember I ended up very fortunate. I won an award and ended up at Sundance at one stage doing the theater program. And there was an Irish dramaturg out there. And I said, what's the story with the Irish? Like, what? Like, honestly, I'm here, but I'd love to put some work on over there. And he says, Irish playwrights to a penny. And I was like, oh, all righty. Wow. And at the time, I thought that's probably cynical. But what he was saying is, yes, we are all storytellers. And along the way, I started realizing that I can keep telling stories about Ireland, or I can tell stories about what it feels like to be an immigrant in America. That became a place that I understood the story. So I began that with something like Brendan. So after the Balia trilogy, Brendan, which kind of was based on an immigrant in America trying to learn how to drive and been taught by a prostitute and kind of coming to terms with all of the American, I realized it's such joy in the piece, even though at the time I was like, what the hell is going on? I don't understand this American theater. But somebody saw the work and said, this could be good. And so that led into stuff like The Compass Rose, or it led into The Smuggler, which led into Thirst. And so I started realizing that I was telling stories that were based in America using immigrant characters, particularly immigrant characters from my background, which is the Irish. And so that seems to be the world that I work in. And sometimes I'll walk out of it and I'll get killed for doing so, like telling a story that's not necessarily in that world. But you end up having to tell the tales you have to tell anyway.
Courtney, I want to widen our lens a little bit. You're now the producing artistic director of the Lyric Stage, and there's a well-worn concept, I think, on the excuse me, the business side of theater, that new plays are hard to sell to audiences. Do you think that's true?
I do think that's true. I think for a number of reasons. There's a reason why so many of us go back to the same recipes, or why we rewatch our favorite movie, or we listen to our favorite album again. I know I fall prey to this. My favorite band just released a new album, and I get scared and nervous to listen to it because what if I don't like this one? Right. And so I think when people are looking for plays, and let's face it, tickets to a lot of theaters are really expensive these days, and that's something for people to consider, where they want to put their money. And if they don't have some sort of tangible connection to it, it's a harder ask of people to ask them to invest their time, their money, and their emotions in something that they don't know. I think when they do, it's so worth it. And every play was a new play at some point. Every play was unknown. Every playwright was that unknown. But it is still, I think, a challenge to get audiences to embrace new works.
And just on that point as well, sorry if I'm cutting in on you. The idea of being a playwright sometimes stops at the door of you write a play and hand it over to an artistic director. And hopefully the artistic director reads it, or you hand it to the lit manager and then you just wait. That's not the way it works. You have to advocate the hell out of it, whether it's writing to somebody like Courtney and asking them to see the play, read the play, or another artistic director. But then I used to think it stopped at that. It doesn't stop at that. Like, we have a big Irish link to Boston, right? And we all know that, but there is no Irish theater in Boston. And so when we actually, not since Sue Gone, really. So the fact that Courtney was taking on this play, I thought to myself, this is a great opportunity to make contact with all these Irish associations that I've come across over the years. And some I haven't even talked to in a long time. So I decided, like, let's advocate for this. And I mentioned it to Courtney as well. So I went out and wrote to the Irish Society and the Irish Cultural Centre and the Irish Pastoral Society and the Irish Consulate. And you'll see that they've put something up already on their Twitter and X files. I have a friend of mine who has billboard company, and he's put the sign up down in Plainville, which I'll visit this weekend and take pictures. And when we'll go down there, Courtney, just because they will support this, because yes. And then whether it's the schools I work at or whatever, and asking them to come to the show. And so now the advocation is also become part of actually bringing audiences in on behalf of the theater, with the theater's blessing as well, because it's not easy. The advocation doesn't stop at this. You have to keep pushing. I guess I'm just putting that addendum onto what Courtney is saying too about new plays.
You anticipated my next question, Ronan, there, because you teach younger writers, you teach emerging playwrights. So is that what you tell them about the business of being a playwright? Is that kind of like constant advocacy for yourself?
I didn't realize it until the last three or four or 5 years. And I also, I thought, yeah, you hand it over and then you talk to the lit managers. But yeah, I mean, the social network has told you to try and reach out to as many people as possible that you think this might link with. So yes, we might be introverted from the outside. That's what it looks like. Stay in your room, write your play. Hope for the best. No. We better keep running down the street, fella, knocking on all the doors.
All right, I'm going to ask both. This is a question for either or both of you. Maybe a little bit deep for this time of day, but there was just an article in the Globe. It's no secret theaters are struggling right now. Companies are closing in Boston and across the country. Pandemic money gone. Things look a little bit grim right now. And yet, I think people have been predicting the demise of theater since the advent of movies and then TV and then streaming. Every time these something comes along, they're like, "Oh, this is going to kill theater," and here we still are. So I'm just wondering, like, as people who are involved in the creation of new plays, what are your feelings on the state of live theater right now, 2024?
I think theater is as challenging as it always has been. I think theater has always been a challenge. I think it is a medium that several people think doesn't speak to them. And I think that means that they just haven't had the right experience yet to let them know that theater is for them. But I completely agree with what you said. I was talking with Actors Shakespeare Project artistic director the other day, Chris Edwards, about the fact that my quote in that Globe article was theater's been dying for 2,000 years. And he said, I said the same thing. It's been dying ever since the first actor walked across the stage. And I think we do have a vibrant future. We know, and we have known for a while, that the regional theater model that all of our cities have been paying very close homage to doesn't quite work. And so I think that we are just in a time where we have to think differently and we have to communicate differently with our audiences. We have to engage them differently, have different conversations, greet new audiences in different ways. But all of that is not bad. All of that is not saying we're going away. It's just saying we have to think a little differently. We have to work a little differently than how we've been working. In a previous season, to your point about new works being more challenging, I could have in a pre-pandemic lyric stage season, I could have programmed 2 to 3 shows that the audience knew and 4 to 5 shows that the audience didn't, and that they would just come with us on that journey. That balance has shifted, and I can't quite program as many unknown titles to them. But that doesn't mean that we can't do it. It doesn't mean that we're not having the conversations, and it doesn't mean that people aren't turning out, because they are. People are showing up. People are happy to be there. People want to be in the theater. We're not dying. We're just transforming. We went into our cocoons for a little bit and we're fighting our way out of them. And I don't know what the butterfly is going to look like, but it's going to be spectacular when we're out.
I'm all in agreement with Courtney on this one as well. And I'll shamelessly plug that I have another play going up in Chicago, The Smuggler. And I have another one going up in Tampa Bay in May, The Smuggler as well. So, yes, I at the moment can tell you that theater's looking fine and bright. Of course, ask me this time next year and I mightn't have a show at all, but that's part of the life of a playwright. It's not part necessarily of the life of theaters. The fact that people get involved at theatre at times is astonishing too, because it is so much work, and yet you keep bringing to life these wonderful characters and putting them on stage, and it's the only place where an audience can come in and have that live effect to say, this is a catharsis for you, or this is a laugh for you, this is tears for you, this is a spectacle of movement to people, almost a murmuration, like you see the birds and you say, watch how they move across the stage, and it looks so simple. And yet it was put in with so much planning. If you saw what Lauren is the name of the props designer, the emails that Lauren gets and what she responds. This woman I have never met, but I'm watching her coming in with all the props in terms of this show. I'm like, we have to sit down. I need to buy you a drink because you're just freaking wonderful. She will talk about a handbag for half a page. It's just, but I saw, that's just my side of things at the moment.
Love it. Love that optimism. We need it. All right. Well, here we are. We've come to the point. We've come to the point. It's game time. And I'm here with, at the very least, one very competitive contestant in Courtney O'Connor. And we are, in fact, going to pit you against each other with a bit of Eugene O'Neill trivia.
Bring it on.
Ronan wins. I give it up.
Well, there's a twist though, so it could still go your way. It could be a lemon twist. It's trivia drinking game. Courtney, what's your adult beverage of choice?
I am an old-fashioned girl.
Old-fashioned girl. You, Ronan?
IPA.
IPA. I'm a Moscow Mule man myself. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to play some trivia. Every time you get a question wrong, you have to drink. We're going to take a quick second, go off air, get those drinks ready, and then we're going to come back for Eugene O'Neill trivia. All right, we are back. Drinks in hand, ready for Eugene O'Neill trivia. Question one is for Ronan. O'Neill passed away on November 27th, 1953, on the fourth floor of a hotel located right here on the Boston University campus. He is rumored to haunt the fourth floor of this building. Which building is it? Is it A, Miles Standish Hall, formerly the Miles Standish Hotel? Is it B, Killichan Hall, formerly the Sheraton Hotel? C, the Hotel Commonwealth? Or D, the Buckminster?
Oh, it's Killijan Hall up on the fourth floor.
It is.
Woo!
One for Ronan. He was confident on that. Oh, very good. We're off to a confident start. Okay, it's question two for Courtney. Long Day's Journey premiered posthumously 1956 in which European country? A, Sweden. B, France. C, Ireland, or D, Czechoslovakia?
I think it was Sweden.
Yes, it was. We are all tied. Courtney comes in there.
Gonna drink anyway because this is just hard.
Yeah, I mean, I can't stop you. All right, question three, for Ronan. Eugene O'Neill was suspended from Princeton after throwing what through future President Woodrow Wilson's office window? I love this question. So he threw something through Wilson's office window. Was it A, a beer bottle, B, a rock, C, a hammer, or D, a whole keg?
I'd have to go with the whole keg just because I prefer that he do that, but I'm not sure I'm right on that one.
I'm sad to say no, it was just a beer bottle, but the whole keg is a more interesting story. So you've hit upon that, not surprisingly. All right, very apropos question for Courtney here. O'Neill's favorite cocktail was which of the following? A, whiskey on the rocks. B, whiskey sour. C, a foghorn, or D, Gibson. And I'll tell you, foghorn, gin, lime, and ginger beer.
I don't know. I'm going to go foghorn just because it's such a fun sounding drink. And whiskey, I think, would be so associated with his father that maybe he went away from it and moved to gin. So I'm going to go foghorn.
All right, well, you're right. It's not whiskey, but no, it was Gibson. Oh, sorry. All right, we're all tied up. Two more questions left. This is going to determine it. Question five for Ronan. In the play, Long Day's Journey into Night, if you wanted to upset James Tyrone, patriarch of the family, what could you say or do? A, suggest Edwin Booth was a better actor than him. B, turn on every light in the house. Or C, insinuate that Shakespeare was Catholic.
Well, you could do all three of those easily.
I was going to say, I think all three would work.
But the one that would really vex him is turning on those freaking lights.
That is correct. Yes. Always turning the lights off because he was a penny pincher. That would also piss off my dad when I was growing up as well, leaving the lights on. So I get it. All right.
Still a bit.
Courtney, here it is. You gotta win this to match him. As I mentioned in his intro, Ronan has won a lot of literary awards, but he has not quite yet won a Pulitzer Prize. So, how many Pulitzer Prizes did Eugene O'Neill win? Is it one, two, three, or four?
I feel like it's three, but I have no idea why.
Is that your final answer?
That's my final answer for all the whiskey in the play.
No, in fact, it was four. Four, the most of anybody, the most Pulitzer Prizes for drama go to O'Neill, including one for Long Day's Journey. And that means the winner is Ronan.
Oh,
2-1.
I drink. We all drink. Let's all drink.
Everybody drinks.
I mean, the play is called Thirst. We have to
Yeah,
drink.
absolutely. That's the whole idea. All right, so the two of you are right now thick in the rehearsals of Thirst. So, Courtney, when does it open? Where can people get tickets?
Thirst opens on the evening of February 23rd, and it runs very appropriately through March 17th. You can get tickets for it at lyricstage.com.
Excellent. I need to get my ticket ASAP. I have to tell you, audience members, this is a fantastic play. The writing is so beautiful. So much juicy subtext. As the kids say these days, it hits me right in the feels. So do yourself a favor, get your tickets right now and go see it as soon as it opens. It's going to be really good. So, Ronan and Courtney, break a leg. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Darren.
Thank you, Darren. Much appreciated.
Today's episode was researched and written by our student producer, Damian Vladimirov, and edited by me. Damian also devised this episode's parody commercial. The theme music is Off to Osaka, and the final credits music is Malt Shop Bop, Hope by Kevin MacLeod. You can find his incredibly wide-ranging music at incompetech.com. That's incompetech.com. For more information about Boston Playwrights Theatre, including our season of new plays, visit bostonplaywrights.org. See you next time.